with this unfinished business, building upon the foundation that has been laid of this little remnant community to increase the positive, offensive unity around common principles and common purpose. We read in Psalm 11, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? I'll tell you what, if you ever have opportunity, and maybe you've already heard it, Brother Rick Ferrer in 1995 gave a talk with that title, if the foundations be destroyed, what can a righteous do? And it was a really good talk. Groups of people require principles to unite them for cooperation. If there's going to be cooperation, people need to know what is expected of them. This is true of any group of people. Our concern is obviously ecclesia, the ecclesia. We need well-defined parameters of belief and morality. When everything is left to individual discretion, there is no common ground of association to draw people together. What does old Jiminy Cricket say? Let your conscience be your guide, right? It just doesn't work out in reality if you're talking about people as a community cooperating. We have to have some well-defined parameters. We go over to Matthew 16. I'm just going to read these real quick. Matthew 16:16. Simon Peter answered and said, Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered and said unto him, Blessed art thou. And he goes on, I say unto thee, I say also unto thee, Thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my ecclesia, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. He's saying it was upon this principle that Peter had just expressed. Thou art the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Upon that foundation rock will I build my ecclesia, Jesus declared. Over in Colossians 1, we're told, verse 23, if ye continue in the faith, grounded and settled, and be not moved away from the hope of the gospel which ye have heard and which was preached to every creature which is under heaven. This is the foundation then. These are the fundamental principles for this unity. And I'm talking about this remnant community here as being the foundation of a spiritual temple, if you will, that has been laid. But they are founded upon this principle foundation, and that is the truth as it is in Christ Jesus, the gospel. The unchanging truth of God must be the foundation basis of unity. And once we are established upon this foundation through baptism into Christ, a responsibility falls upon us, because Paul tells Timothy in 1 Timothy 3:15, the house of God, which is the ecclesia of the living God, is the pillar and ground of the truth. The pillar and support of the truth. So we've got this mutual relationship then. We are founded and on that foundation of God's truth. And then when we come into that body, it's our responsibility to support those principles of truth. And that's what we should be doing mutually, it says here. The ecclesia of the living God, the house of God, is to be the pillar and ground or support of the truth. So, I'm establishing that so there's no confusion as we move on. I tried to establish in that first class, there is a remnant community, and it is somewhat of a foundation that's been laid for us to cooperate in working to build up. What I'm going through here and going to suggest in this class, it doesn't apply. We don't do this with people of other communities, okay? These are things that I'm suggesting we do and build upon the foundation that's laid here with this remnant community. And within this remnant community, there is much work left to be done. And For the exhortation on this, I want to look at the book of Ezra. Ezra 3, starting in the first verse. We're told, when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. So here we have this picture of unity. Not in opposition to anything particularly, though that did come. But they were united to support and to engage in a certain work, to build something, okay? They gathered themselves together as one man to Jerusalem. Then stood up Joshua, the son of Jozadak, high priest, and his brethren the priests, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor, and his brethren, and builded the altar of God, of the God of Israel, to offer burnt offerings thereon, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So we see this united for a common purpose as one man to rebuild the temple. Go over to the sixth verse. From the first day of the seventh month began they to offer burnt offerings unto Yahweh. But the foundation of the temple of Yahweh was not yet laid. So they built the altar first. And now we see the foundation of the temple was not yet laid. And I think we're skipping down to verse 8. The end of verse 8. Yes. Skip down to the end of verse 8 where we read, they appointed the Levites from 20 years old and upward to set forward the work of the house of Yahweh. They built that altar. They made several offerings, and then they set forward this work of building the house of Yahweh. Then stood Joshua with his sons and his brethren, Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, together to set forward the workmen in the house of God, the sons of Henadad with their sons and their brethren, the Levites. And when the builders laid the foundation of the temple of Yahweh and set the priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise Yahweh after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. And they sang together by course in praising and giving thanks. Remember that gratitude, thanksgiving we read about back in Colossians, the third chapter. They sang together upon the laying of this foundation, praising and giving thanks unto Yahweh, because He is good, for His mercy endureth forever toward Israel. And they recognized that the laying of this foundation and their escape from Babylon and being allowed to do this, and this remnant from Babylon being preserved, they recognized that this was an expression of God's goodness and mercy toward Israel. And they were thankful for it and joyful for it and grateful. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised Yahweh, because the foundation of the house of Yahweh was laid. But many of the priests and Levites and chief of the fathers, who were ancient men that had seen the first house, when the foundations of this house, Zerubbabel and Joshua's day, when the foundations of this house were laid before their eyes, those that saw the Temple of Solomon's building, they wept with a loud voice. And many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not discern the noise of the shout of joy from the noise of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the noise was heard afar off, much to the suspicion of the Samaritans neighboring them, obviously. So, we've got one event. Everybody observed the same thing. Altar and the foundation of the temple being laid. And we have two completely different reactions to the same thing. Two perspectives observing this same event. Now, if we go over to Haggai, the second chapter, we see Yahweh's estimation of this weeping reaction, I believe. Haggai 2, verse 3. Through Haggai, the Lord says, "Who is left among you that saw this house in her first glory?" In other words, those ancient men that wept with a loud voice, that had seen the first house, that are spoken of there in Ezra, the third chapter. "Who have left among you that saw this house in her first glory, and how do ye see it now? Is it not in your eyes in comparison of it as nothing?" But what does he say? "Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith Yahweh, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest, and be strong," three times over there, "all ye people of the land, saith Yahweh, and work. For I am with you, saith Yahweh of hosts." So he left no confusion on this point. Who was with Solomon, and David for that matter, when he was preparing the materials, who was with them to build the temple of Solomon's day? Yahweh. And he's saying to them now, you see that this is nothing in comparison to that. Be strong, be strong, be strong, work. I'm with you. The same as he was with Solomon in that great and magnificent temple that he built. He was with them to build this relatively insignificant one, relative to Solomon's temple. Zechariah 4, we have this addressing the same thing. Zechariah 4, verse 8. "Moreover, the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house. His hands shall also finish it. And thou shalt know that Yahweh of hosts hath sent me unto you. For who hath despised the day of small things, for they shall rejoice." And it goes on there about the work of Zerubbabel. Now this word despise, who hath despised the day of small things? The word despise here would literally be translated as hold as insignificant or disrespect. And this, I believe, is also addressing the attitude of those who were weeping with a loud voice when they saw the foundation of this temple, and they remembered back to the great temple that they saw destroyed at the hands of the Babylonians, of Solomon's building. They despised the day of small things, the relatively, compared to that, insignificant. They held it as insignificant and they disrespected it because of what they were thinking back upon. The value of a work is not determined by its size or its scope. Every work appointed by Yahweh is valuable and important, despite its apparent insignificance in comparison to things past or even contemporary, other things that are going on around us. We should not despise the work, consider it insignificant, or disrespect it, but we should do it with enthusiasm and joy, after the example of what I suspect is the majority of those that had returned to do this work under Zerubbabel. There is no work appointed by God that is too small or insignificant for Him to take note of it. Even rebuilding this little remnant community, building upon this foundation that we have laid here for us. What is our reaction to witnessing the laying of this foundation, of this spiritual temple or ecclesial new community? We look upon it with the joy, praising Yahweh as We see those singing in Ezra the third chapter. Do we look upon it with that attitude, praising Yahweh and giving thanks for His goodness and mercy toward us and providing this provision and giving us this provision, making this provision? Do we have this gratitude and thankfulness? Or do we look upon it and compare it to what we remember having previously and weep? Or think about what somebody else has and weep? So the question is, are we thankful? Or do we disrespect, despise it? I am afraid that at times we do not value what God has provided us here in this community as highly as we should. This is the work. This is what we have been given to work with. Not anything else. And therefore we need to do the best that we can with what we have, because it's what we're not given anything else to build upon, to work with right now. So, now, after all that rejoicing, as we mentioned, Samaritans hear word of this, they come into the picture, and they get that foundation laid, and then the work comes to a dead stop at the hands of the Samaritan threat. They stop the work successfully by obtaining a letter from the king Artaxerxes the Persian, and the building of the temple stopped for 15 years. However, while they stopped building the temple of the Lord, the house of God, we know that what they actually did was they went about building up their own houses, didn't they? They were able to build and work for themselves and take care of their own concerns, but they were not able to work on the temple of the Lord. It says in Ezra 4, I'm just going to read this portion here. The end of verse 4, it says, they ran with this letter, the Samaritans, and made them, the Jews, to cease by force and power of human design. So this temple continues unfinished. Foundation laid and nothing else until the arrival of Haggai and Zechariah 15 years later. And Zechariah brings with him a critical lesson, I believe. Let's look over at Zechariah 4. Zechariah 4, verse 6. It says, then he answered and spake unto me, saying, this is the word of Yahweh unto Zerubbabel, saying, not by might, nor by power. Now what was it that stopped the work of the temple? Those things. He says, in Ezra 4 we just read, the Samaritans made them to cease by force and power, or I believe that is the same word if I'm not mistaken, by might and power in the Hebrew. Now Zechariah comes in and he says, this is the word of Yahweh, not by might, nor by power, but by my spirit, saith Yahweh of hosts. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, thou shalt become a plain. And he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, grace, grace unto it. Now what was the great mountain that Zechariah is speaking of? It's an actual question. What was the great mountain? The great mountain was this obstacle to the completion of the temple. It was the Samaritans and the Persians with the letter that they'd received. This was the great obstacle or mountain that stood in the way of the Jews finishing the work that they had been sent back specifically to do with a letter from Cyrus. Right? These Samaritans were the great obstacle or mountain in this immediate sense. And there's typical and symbolic implications to this that we're not talking about today. Who art thou, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel, thou shalt become a plain. Zechariah, instead of viewing, of course he's inspired here, sharing the words of Yahweh, the perspective of Yahweh, I would suggest. Zechariah shows disdain, not for the temple that Yahweh had sent them there to build, but for the mountain that was standing in the way of it. Who art thou? Who are you to inhibit God's work? Who are you to threaten God's anointed ones? Who are you to be feared? And then he says, before Zerubbabel, thou shalt become a plain. So in this brief passage, I believe, here in the fourth chapter, Zechariah addresses both the enemies of Israel. The enemy without, the great mountain, the Samaritans. But also the enemy within, despising the day of small things, the thinking in their own heads. Who are we to despise the day of small things if it's the work that God has appointed? Now, the question then is, did the mountain even exist? Only existed as long as they believed it did. When their perspective was changed from the natural to the spiritual, and I would suggest when they developed, through the help and exhortation of Haggai and Zechariah, faith to transform their perspective to the divine, the mountain became a plain. Bad information, bad thinking, leads to bad decisions. It was not irrational for men to be afraid of sea traveling when they thought the earth was flat, was it? It made perfect sense. If you think the earth is flat, and if you venture out too far at sea, you're going to fall off the side of the world, you don't go out to sea. However, if your premise is wrong, then your fear makes no sense. Hosea 4, we're told, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. It was not irrational for the Jews to fear the Samaritans and the order of the king Artaxerxes when that was all they knew, human might and power. Now this is a very critical lesson for both temporal as well as spiritual matters. And that is, consider the sources of your information. Where are you getting these ideas that are leading to this behavior? Assemble all the information you can and make sure that you have a complete picture before drawing a conclusion and acting upon it. Proverbs 18, we're told, he that answereth a matter before he heareth it, it is folly and shame unto him. That's Proverbs 18, verse 13. And then he explains why partly in verse 17, Proverbs 18, 17, when he says, he that is first in his own cause seemeth just, but his neighbor cometh and searcheth him. And I think that this is a little more clear in the ESV, where it says, the one who states his case first seems right until the other one comes and examines him. Okay? Make sure we're getting a complete picture. This was the mistake of the Jews. They were listening to and reacting to the problems posed by the Samaritans, the King Artaxerxes. And where do we have? We have no reference to them consulting Yahweh as to how to address this and move forward. They receive this letter and it says, the work ceased. They saw the enemies of Yahweh as a great mountain while at the same time disrespecting the work that God had given them to do as a day of small things and insignificant. Great is the opposition to the Lord. Great is this obstacle. And little is the work that He has given to us to do. Why would they put forth any effort and take their lives in their own hands to perform that work that they didn't even think was important? The problem was the thinking. They underestimated the divine work given to them and blew the strength of His enemies out of proportion. Zechariah demonstrated what needed to happen within the Jews to move forward. They had to transform their perspective. He and Haggai helped with this by adding the divine perspective through their prophecy to the Jews' knowledge. So, no longer would it be that they were destroyed for lack of knowledge, that God's work was inhibited for lack of knowledge. Haggai and Zechariah provided what was lacking. So the question is, do we limit our effort in the work given to us in this, to rebuild this temple, by our thinking, by not fully appreciating that it is the responsibility entrusted to us by Yahweh? Do we minimize the importance of our work by comparing it to previous times or ages? Do we exaggerate the obstacles that stand before us in accomplishing this work? Do we consult God and His Word for His perspective in order to correct our own? The prophet's message is summarized in Haggai 2, verse 4, where he says, "Yet now be strong," and we've read this already, but it's critical. "Yet now be strong, O Zerubbabel, saith Yahweh, and be strong, O Joshua, son of Jozadak, the high priest. And be strong, all ye people of the land." In other words, everybody's covered. The governor, the high priest, and then the population. "Everyone be strong and work, for I am with you, saith Yahweh of hosts." And this is what I'm proposing. We need to take on this same attitude. This is the work given to us. So we move on. After 15 years, the arrival of Haggai and Zechariah, they stir things up, prophesying and exhorting them, telling them to examine themselves. We know in Ezra, the people return to building and complete the temple after 15 years of laying dormant. Ezra 5, we read. I'm going to read these passages relatively quickly now. The prophets Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, I'm in Ezra 5, 1, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. "Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. And with them were the prophets of God helping them." Ezra 6, 14, "The elders of the Jews built it, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah, the son of Iddo. And they built it and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel," which we've already read in Zechariah, "and according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia," which were involved. We didn't get into all that. "The house was finished on the third day of the month Adar," and so on and so forth. Despite no change in their external circumstances, the order from Artaxerxes from 15 years before that said stop the work, the Samaritans brought it and made them stop by force and by power, by might and by power, was standing. Nothing had happened in regard to that. The Samaritans were still opposing them. Perhaps not as actively, because the Jews weren't working actively. They were just building up their own houses. And so long as they were concerned about their own affairs, Samaritans knew they didn't have anything to worry about, did they? Nothing had changed in their external surroundings, in their reality. The only thing that changed, that took this obstacle out of the way, was in the mind of the Jews, and it happened with the introduction of the divine perspective upon their situation. So, they start working again. The Samaritans protest. They write another letter. They get a letter back from the king. But this time, guess what? The Jews did everything in their power to accomplish what was given to them. And God providentially took care of everything that they didn't have any control over. And the king wrote back and he said, leave them alone. And in fact, you can help them. Because they went about their work instead of just dropping off. This is the way that the mountain was turned into a plain. No change in circumstance whatsoever. The only change that caused that work to commence again, was in their own thinking. They came to realize God's power is as much a part of reality as the things that we can actually see before our eyes. God's power is as much a part of reality as the things that we observe. Okay? and the letter that they'd received from Artaxerxes. Good information leads to good decisions, like getting back to work and building that temple. Now, there's an excellent example in Abraham of this, and Sarah, and the birth of Isaac. But I don't have time to get into it. But if you look at Romans 4:18 through 21, we're told Abraham believed something that was physically impossible would happen. Now, Isaac's birth was not after the manner of Jesus' birth. Isaac was the son of Abraham and Sarah. When the angels came and said, "You're going to have a son," there was something that was required of Abraham and Sarah for that son to be born. And Abraham was 100 and Sarah was 90. They took the action that they had to do, and God provided the strength for the rest to be done. If they had not believed that God's power was as much a part of reality as their own 190-year-old bodies, they wouldn't have believed and done what was required of them for the promised seed to be born. This is why he's presented as the father of the faithful. Okay, now we're skipping down here a little more on Haggai, Zechariah, Zerubbabel, and Joshua. In these four men, we have the example of brethren of different ability, different talent, uniting for a common purpose. Though they served in different roles in this work, they nonetheless shared a common purpose. And their example reignited the willing spirit in the remnant to go, as they had so many years before, as one man, united in that purpose, to Jerusalem to build the temple. When they began to perform their part, the king of Persia was even made to cooperate with them. As we know from Proverbs 16, when a man's ways please Yahweh, he maketh even his enemies to be at peace with him. Now, here's a question. Have you ever tried to walk on your hands? It's not easy. Here's something even harder. Have you ever tried to smell a flower, a rose, with your ear? Don't do that. Okay. If you try to smell a rose with your ear and it doesn't work, do you get mad at the ear? No. It's not the ear's fault that it cannot smell. It has the sense of hearing. It's your fault for trying to do something wrong with that part of the body. Not do something wrong. Do the wrong thing with that part of the body. It's not the ear's fault. The ear was created for a specific purpose. Does that mean that it's useless? No. It's designed for a specific purpose, as we've already said. Don't have to say it again. If the whole body was an ear, it wouldn't actually be a body, would it? Because there's no such thing as a body that is just ears. Now, here's a good one. Have you ever thought, why can't they just do things my way? You ever wished everybody would just do things your way, John? Ever wondered why they can't be more like you? Well, even Paul said himself, "For I would that all men were even as I myself." So, he says, I would that all men were even as myself. But he quickly tells the Corinthians, "But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that." See, he wasn't so selfish or self-centered to not bring into mind the divine perspective. Every man has his proper gift of God after different manners. Joshua, Zerubbabel, the prophets, and the people all had well-defined roles and responsibilities. And I don't have time to go through all of these passages here, evidently. Romans 12, though, picking a few things out from starting in the third verse, he says, through the grace that is, I say, through the grace given unto me, every man, through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith, just as he said back in the seventh chapter of 1 Corinthians. For as we have many members in one body, and all members have not the same office, so we, being many, are one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. How do you think Joshua, Zerubbabel, Haggai, and Zechariah worked to accomplish their purpose? I don't think that Zerubbabel was going around trying to make Zechariah and Haggai be governors. Nor do I think that he was trying to be a prophet or a high priest as Joshua. I think they all recognized that they had an appointed purpose for the accomplishment of this work, and that it was when these respective positions were all occupied that the work could actually be accomplished and that temple could be built. That's evidently the case because it didn't happen until those positions were filled. With mutual respect and cooperation, the temple was completed. If we recognize that we have received gifts and talents as a result of the grace of God, we should be humbled and think of ourselves soberly, with gratitude to God for His provision, for giving us an ability to do some particular thing, whatever it may be. There is no reason to think highly of ourselves, or anyone else for that matter, for our or their ability, because we have received these gifts and these blessings and these provisions from God. Now, I'm trying to figure out. Just one second. Okay. As we're told in 1 Corinthians 4, 6, he says he appointed himself and Apollos as an example that we might learn through their example not to think of men above that which is written, that no one of you be puffed up one against another. For who maketh thee to differ from another? God. That's who. And what hast thou that thou didst not receive? Nothing. It's all been given to us. Now, if thou didst receive it, why dost thou glory as if thou hadst not received it, as if it's something of your own creation? Ephesians 4:11, he gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And this is the purpose for which these gifts were given. And not only those spirit gifts, as was the case in some of those things just said, but in your talent, which we're not going to read from Matthew 25, the parable of the talents. But what we know from it is this. Everyone was rewarded except for one person, and that was the person that didn't cultivate his talent, that didn't work with what was given to him. And we're told in there plainly, the Lord does not sow, the Lord does not reap where He has not sown. That was the response of this obstinate one talent person. I buried it in the ground. I know you. You reap where you haven't sown. He says, oh really? You know that I reap where I haven't sown? Well, then you should have took what I actually gave you, and I should have had what I gave you with usury at my return. He buried it in the ground. We know the Lord does not reap where He hasn't sown, because He didn't expect the man with two talents to produce 10. He was rewarded for doubling what he had, the same as the man with 5 was rewarded for his work. Now, I got a minute, I think. We have comfort and encouragement there in the parable of the talents, which we aren't reading, but you're familiar with it. And that is this. Production is required for reward. But God does not expect us to produce more than we are able. He doesn't put my burden upon you and He doesn't put your burden upon me. In 1 Corinthians 12, we have the example of the ecclesia as the body. We're not reading it. But we see in it that God ordained the body to be made up of various parts. And we liken these to talents, personalities, areas of emphasis, however you want to represent it. These diversity of abilities, while all founded upon the same truth. And God says all those parts are necessary. And why is that? Because a body that is lacking even its weakest member is mutilated. It's unwhole. Even the thing that we don't like that much on our body, if it's gone, our body is unwhole and it's mutilated. And if we get that old joke, the kid comes limping into the house from the snow, and the mom says, "What happened?" He says, "I got hit in the ear with a snowball." The whole body hurts when we're hurt. This is the parable that we're given here in 1 Corinthians 12. Let's take a break. We'll pick up that and finish it, and then we'll move on to the third class.